You're listening to a University of Minnesota Bookstore author event podcast, recorded live from our location in Kauffman Memorial Union on the U of M's Twin Cities campus. For more information on upcoming author events, please visit our website at bookstore.umn.edu.
Our special guest today is Wendell Potter. He is currently a senior analyst at the Center for Public Integrity and a senior fellow on healthcare at the Center for Media and Democracy. He has appeared on countless television and radio programs and has been quoted in newspapers and magazines around the world. Prior to his 25-year career in public relations, he was a journalist for the Memphis Press Scimitar and the Scripps Howard News Service. Some of you may have heard him on public radio this morning with Carrie Miller. I heard he gave a great interview. We're really pleased to have him talk with us today and answer your questions. Please join me in welcoming Wendell Potter.
Thank you very much, Terry, and thank you all for coming out today late in the afternoon. I really appreciate your coming out and being willing to stand up. I'll not talk too long. I'll talk for a few minutes, but I always enjoy the Q&A best or most, and I'd like to have a conversation with you all and just determine what's on your minds and then attempt to answer any questions you might have. You're probably very busy today. You're probably going to and from class or just your routine and haven't tuned in probably a lot to C-SPAN today to watch the probably one of the best shows in the country that's going on right now in Washington. It is political theater, so it can be pretty entertaining if you know how to watch it and to know what's going on. Because what's going on is not what it appears to be. There will be a vote today on repealing the health care reform legislation unless something delays it. And there are the votes to pass it. It will pass. And it's being done, and I'm not being cynical, but it's being done as a gesture to the folks who voted in enough Republicans for it to change control. And a lot of those candidates campaigned on a platform of repealing and replacing this legislation or the legislation that was signed into law last March. And those folks were led to believe that this was a government takeover of the health care system. It was not, by any stretch of the imagination. Far from it. Far from it. Why I call it the biggest show in town is that it is it's political theater, and if we watch it for what is going on today, we'll miss what is actually going on. It's in many ways it's a smokescreen to what the real agenda is by those who really helped elect these folks. And when I say they, I'm not talking about the people who voted in the voting booths, but the people who contributed to their campaigns and who made sure that the House changed control. And we're talking about the insurance industry and its lobbyists primarily. While they are voting today, they're getting that out of the way. They know it's not going to pass in the Senate, and they know that even if Harry Reid lost his mind and let it come up for a vote, and it passed the Senate, which it wouldn't because there are more Democrats than Republicans in the Senate still, that the president would certainly veto it. So it's not going to happen. They are saying that once this bill passes, which it will in the House, that then the committee chairs will begin working on legislation to replace this bill. What is really going on is... In fact, probably as soon as all the votes were counted, the insurance industry executives and their lobbyists were scheduling meetings with the membership of the Republican Party who are assuming the leadership roles in Congress. And, in fact, almost every member of Congress that now represents them and said, here is the deal. We know you had to campaign on this. It helped to get you here. We helped, of course, to finance your campaigns, and we know you have to go through the gesture of repealing this legislation. So go to it and get that out of the way whenever you think the timing is right. Continue to do this, to talk about this as long as you want, because we know that the more you talk about this being a government takeover, the more people will buy into it and believe it, and that will enable you to attack pieces of the legislation that we, the insurance industry, don't like. So The thing that they like most, by the way, is the thing that a lot of Republicans are saying is unconstitutional, and that is the requirement that we all have to buy health insurance from the private insurance companies. The insurance companies had two objectives. They knew, by the way, that reform was inevitable, and they were correct in saying that they supported reform because they know that their current business models are not sustainable in the long haul. They were not sustainable unless there was a government requirement that we all buy their products. So they are the ones who are chiefly behind this legislation, or the mandate in there, which, by the way, was originally a Republican idea. You would never, they're not owning up to it now, but it was originally an idea going back to Bob Dole when he was in the Senate and was running for president as well. And it is, it was proposed by them as a way to lock in the private health insurance industry into our health care system and to keep it going and thriving. And the insurance companies know that that's essential. Their business models are not sustainable because it is built on shifting more and more of the cost of health care from them to us. You all know about the managed care revolution, and you all know about the backlash against managed care. The revolution was led by the insurance industry right after they were able to kill the Clinton plan, which regrettably I was a part of helping to do. They said at the time is let us now have our chance to reform the healthcare system. Let us take charge because we can bring more people into coverage. We can bring costs down. Well, see what happened. We can see what happened. We thought the healthcare system was in crisis in 1993 when the Clintons came into office and tried to reform it. It is in much worse shape now than it was before. 51 million of us are now uninsured, and probably more than that because that's based on 2009 census data. At least 25 million more of us are underinsured. That was not something that was of great concern back in 1993, but it is an area that we really need to be very concerned about because more and more of us are going to wind up there, and probably some of you are already there in the ranks of the underinsured, and that means that you are going to have to pay 10%, at least 10% of your own money, your own income, out of your own pocket, even if you are insured, if you get sick or have an accident. And that's what they want to do. They're going to continue to try to shift more and more of the cost to us, but that's not sustainable in the long haul. There is a limit. You can't keep doing that forever and expect that people are going to voluntarily keep buying your product. That is why this mandate is so essential to them. So the conversations that have been going on behind closed doors, in back rooms in the Capitol and the House and Senate office buildings, are meetings in which the lobbyists for these companies are saying, here's the deal. We like the individual mandate. Go ahead and do your vote. We know it's necessary. But once you do, here's what you can do for us, your benefactors. And if you do what we want, then you can count on us being there for you when you run for re-election. And if you have a primary opponent or an opponent in the general election, we can rely on us to help pour money into your campaign or into an effort to defeat your opponent. So here's what we really need. We need for you to strip out some of the consumer protections that are in this legislation that we don't like. And here are some talking points that you guys can use to sell this to the American public. I call this book Deadly Spin for a good reason, because this spin that you have been hearing and that you will continue to hear is deadly. And I note in the very first of the book that 45,000 people die every year in this country because they don't have health insurance, and that means that they don't have the same amount of access or the same access to care that people who do have insurance do. They wait too late often to get the care they need. They wait to show up to the emergency room when their health is so far gone that it doesn't work for them. And other people just never even make it to the emergency room. They die. And that's 123 people every single day that die because they don't have access to health insurance. And I realized toward the end of my career in the industry that I was at least partly responsible for that shameful statistic, as I note in the book. The spin that I helped create has made people believe things that are not true, and to obscure that reality. I'm on talk shows all the time, and people will call in and question that statistic. And I say back to them, well, how many people in this country, what is an acceptable number then for people to die in this country? Because if it's not 45,000, what if just two people do die? In my book, that's too many. But the sad reality is it's in the thousands every year. There's some things about this legislation, again, that they like. They like the individual mandate. That was job one. Job two was to make sure that the public option was stripped out of the legislation, and that happened. So they got the two major objectives from Congress. When Obama was campaigning for president, by the way, he campaigned against the individual mandate. He said that he did not think it was appropriate for people to have to buy an insurance product that they can't afford. And he was for a public option. Of course, by the end of this debate on the bill, he had pretty much flipped. He was embracing an individual mandate, and he was willing to give up the public option. He certainly was not willing to fall on his sword for it, and he didn't. And because the insurance industry had been so successful in the Senate in getting one or two key senators, Joe Lieberman in particular, to block the bill if the public option were still a part of it, that they got what they wanted. So in many ways, this legislation was a huge victory for the health insurance industry, but not entirely. The big for-profit companies were not happy enough about the bill. They don't like the fact that they are now required, beginning the first of this year, to spend at least 80% of what we send them in premiums on medical care. They don't like that. Because their owners, the Wall Street analysts, and their stockholders have been constantly pressuring them to spend less and less on claims and medical care. Because the less you spend on care, the more is available to reward them and the CEOs, and to spend on other on overhead in general. The other thing that is, you know, there are many things that they don't like. They don't like being told that they can't charge older folks more than three times as much as they charge young people. They hate that because they want to go back to the old days of being able to charge older folks as much as they think they can get it, well, more than they can get away with, because there is no one telling them they can't do it until now. They don't like that. They don't like being told they can't do anything, so they hate regulations. And they don't like being told that they have to allow families or parents to keep children on the policy until age 26, unless those kids can find jobs that offer benefits. They don't like that. So what will be going on is an attempt, and what is going on, to strip these and other consumer protections and regulations out of the bill. This bill makes it illegal for them to refuse to sell us insurance because we've had a pre-existing condition. They don't particularly like that. They don't like being told that they can't cancel policies just because they want to, and they want to avoid paying claims. They have been engaging this practice called rescission, in which the insurance companies have been quite able to cancel policies when someone's in the midst of being treated for some significant illness, and leaving them to pay the full amount. There was a woman who testified before a House committee just before I testified before Congress. That she got a notice from her insurance carrier that they were canceling her policy. She was in the midst of being treated for breast cancer, so she was, you know, there were quite a few claims that were coming in that they were having to pay. They didn't like that, so they had someone look at the application she filled out when she applied for insurance, and they looked at her medical records. They matched them up, or tried to, and they found that for some reason she had failed to disclose that she had been treated for acne at some time in the past. And so they canceled her policy because she did not disclose that she had been treated for acne. These are the guys, folks, who run our health care system. People just simply do not realize that the health insurance industry is in charge of our health care system. It's in their grips, and they can do pretty much what they want with providers. During the debate, we were made to fear this government takeover of the healthcare system. We were made to fear death panels. We were made to fear having a government bureaucrat standing between us and our doctors. Well, the reality is that while we were not paying attention, we've had a Wall Street takeover of our healthcare system. We've had a corporate takeover. And death panels indeed do exist. They exist within these big for-profit corporations. And I work for two of them. There are seven very, very large, actually eight if you count Centene, that control our health insurance system and thereby control the health insurance system. They control our health care system. One out of every three of us is now enrolled in a health benefit plan that is offered or operated by one of those seven big firms, one of which is based just a few miles from here, United. In terms of revenue and profit, it is the biggest in the country. More than 30 million people are enrolled in those in a United plan around the country, although not here so much. WellPoint is its top rival, and in some ways, if you count membership, WellPoint's the biggest. So these are two of the biggest. Then you have Aetna, and then you have Cigna and Humana, and I worked for Humana as well as Cigna. You have HealthNet and Coventry and Centene. So you've got a few of these big companies that control our healthcare system. I call it a cartel. And they've grown to this size in just recent years. You probably knew about United long before the rest of the country did, but it was a relatively small company when I first started working for the insurance industry. Now it's one of the behemoths, and it has grown that way through mergers and acquisitions. Over the past several years, we've had 400 mergers and acquisitions in the insurance industry, to the point that we just have the illusion of choice in this country. So I'll wind up by just giving you some things to look for over the coming days and weeks as the spin really kicks into high gear on both sides, quite frankly. But the opponents of this bill, or those who want to retool it, and that's the operative word here, or replace it with something else, they will be trying to persuade us that these consumer protections are not really in our best interest after all. And the reason is because if you leave them on the books and insurance companies have to comply with them, then they will have to raise your premiums. So we can't afford these consumer protections. They will say that these insurance companies have been forced to push us into a one-size-fits-all kind of healthcare policy or a healthcare plan, that is taking choice away from Americans, when in reality, the choice has been taken away from us by the health insurance companies themselves. But they'll spin that. They'll make us believe that it is this legislation that is taking choice away from us. And choice is one of those words that they use all the time because they know that it's a word that resonates well. So they'll use that against advocates of reform. And they will say that insurance companies need to have more flexible benefit design. That is important to them. And that's code word for let us continue to be able to market and sell junk insurance. Let us continue to be able to market and sell these plans that enable us to charge so much in deductibles that people are more and more going to be in the ranks of the underinsured. There's a WellPoint, for example, operates a plan in Maine under the Anthem brand that has a $30,000 a year deductible. $30,000. So people are paying their hard-earned money for premiums for a plan like that that also has very limited benefits. So that's what their future is for us. And that's what they want their newly elected members of Congress to do, is to let us return to the days when they, kind of the Wild West days of little regulation, so that they can continue to treat us this way. And they need to do that because that's what they need to do to satisfy Wall Street. I'll say one more thing, and then I'll open it up to questions. I hear often that from folks on the right and people who are business owners who really believe in the free market, and they say, well, why can't the free market work in healthcare like it does in other sectors of the economy? If we just have fewer regulations on the industry, then it will operate very efficiently and for the benefit of consumers. Well, it just doesn't work that way in healthcare. Target doesn't care whether you're young or old when they sell you stuff. They don't check to see how old you are before they sell you something. They don't check to see how healthy you are, whether you've had a pre-existing condition. They don't care whether you're male or female. But health insurance companies care about all of that, very much care about all of that. And they care about it so much that they will not sell you their product if they think that you are not who they want. So it doesn't work in healthcare, in health insurance, because they, over many years, have been refusing to sell their products to those of us who really need it, or charging us so much for it that a lot of people can't afford it. With that, I'll end, and we'll just have a little conversation here for a while. Thank you very much. Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
As you've traveled around the country and on your book tour, what efforts have you seen that are most effective from grassroots levels to expose the insurance industry? Grassroots groups that don't have big PR corporations working for them, what kind of efforts really help expose what's going on?
Well, part of the grassroots effort involves having people within those organizations make calls to lawmakers and make calls to regulators. That's a very important thing. You need to also watch language. That's very, very important. As I, you know, threw out some of those terms, they're carefully crafted and they're very succinct and they're repeatable. So the thing you have to do is to distill your message into a few words that has some emotional punch to it. I'm often asked a similar question, well, what language can we use? And that's why I use that example of countering a government takeover with a corporate takeover or a Wall Street takeover. So those organizations that are most successful understand the importance of language and messaging. When the Senate was preparing to vote for the bill on Christmas Eve 2009, Claire McCaskill, the Democratic senator from Missouri, was asked, well, what happened? Why does this bill differ so much from the House bill? Why does it not include the public option that you all said was so important? And she said a few words that just, I think, were the heart of the advocates' problem, or at least Democrats' problem, and that was, we lost the messaging battle. So the ones that are most successful are those who understand the importance of communications and the importance of figuring out ways to connect with people emotionally and not just throw out a bunch of facts and figures. Progressives and advocates, I've found, seem to think that if you just appeal to someone's head, if you can explain why why in the world would we not have a single-payer system when all the research shows that it would save us a lot of money and people would get the care they'd need and we'd have universal coverage? You know, logically, it makes sense. But the opponents have been able to make people see single-payer in different ways, as socialism, for example. So they've been able to define single-payer in ways that scare a lot of people. So just... you have to pay attention to the tools your opponents use and the words they use, and get in the game by following the rules that they set, because they pretty much set the rules. Yes, sir.
Can you predict a time, and if so, I'll get to the second half, can you predict a time when or do you think this would happen? Can you predict a time when there will be a train derailment of such magnitude that even at least the thoughtful Republicans would start to think about it and admit that maybe we ought to look at one payer, either nationally or state by state? And if you can predict that time, what factor or combinations of factors would have to come together to get to that point?
Well, that point will be a few years down the road. I can't pinpoint it, but I do think it will happen, because even with this legislation and the requirement that we all buy their products, people will, that's the least popular thing about this legislation. People realize that those health insurance policies are often overpriced. They resent being told they have to buy it, and I sure understand that. I think we will get to the point of realizing that we're forced to buy something that doesn't give us very much value, that doesn't provide the protection that we really need. And we will reach a tipping point sometime in the future in which when we will all, or at least a majority of us, will realize wow, this is just not working for us. And it will take some time, but it will require more and more of us to feel the pain of that. Right now, we have a system in which a lot of people will say that I'm happy with my health insurance. They're happy with it because they don't realize how much they're paying for it, nor do they realize how inadequate it can be if they really get sick. And, you know, most of us are blessed with fairly good health. We go year after year, and we don't have to use a lot of our benefits, and it's only those who have the misfortune of getting very, very sick or being in accidents that they realize often the inadequacy of those plans. But sooner or later, more and more of us are going to realize that, hey, wait a minute. I'm being forced to buy something. I'm having to pay premiums. Or a lot of folks under this bill, if they can't afford the premiums, the government will help subsidize them. And I think people will ultimately wake up to that. However, they'll wake up to it sooner if you guys can help make sure that they understand what's going on. Yes, sir.
At the present time, we have somewhere around 9.7% unemployment in this country. And obviously, everybody's talking about providing and making more jobs. If we were able to wave a magic wand and tomorrow we were able to have single-payer health insurance in this country, how many jobs would be lost in the insurance industry? And the second question I have is, can we have something in the law that would allow us to retrain some of those individuals that might be out of a job in the insurance industry?
Yeah, I don't know how many, but yeah if he was asking if we did have single payer, how many jobs would be lost in the health insurance industry, and how could some of those people be retrained? I don't know. But here's the things you need to know about the health insurance industry workforce. It's smaller than it used to be. A lot of the functions are automated. A lot of the functions have been moved offshore. You may not realize that, but a lot of functions have been outsourced and are performed outside of the United States. So it takes fewer people to do what it used to do because of this automation. And as you move to more to electronic medical records, there'll be need for fewer and fewer. When I worked at Cigna, there was a report of the Hartford Current, which is, you know, the insurance capital of America, supposedly, not so much as it used to be. But there was a reporter who always her first question I knew whenever we announced earnings was, well, how many employees does Cigna have in Connecticut? And how does that compare with 3 months ago or a year ago? And every time we did that, there were fewer and fewer employees. And most people don't realize that because that's been happening as we've seen this change that I spoke about. The other thing is that a lot of these people wouldn't necessarily leave these companies. They would not be involved in basic medical coverage, but these companies will continue to exist. They will morph into something else. And they already are morphing into something else. When I joined the health insurance industry in 1989, it was very, very different from what it is now. Very, very different. I went to work for Humana in 89 when Humana was mostly known as a hospital company. Wall Street, but it also had a thriving managed care division. And Wall Street told these guys who were running it, look, get rid of your hospitals so you can focus on health insurance because we think you can make more money there. And they were right. And that's why Humana today is a big managed care company that does not operate any hospitals. 4 years later, when I joined Cigna, it was a big multi-line insurance company. Wall Street said the same thing to Cigna, to Aetna, to Prudential, Travelers, MetLife. All of these were the big four multi-line insurance companies. They said, look, guys, focus on one or two businesses and get rid of the rest. And that's what happened. Cigna and Aetna decided to focus on health insurance. They sold their financial services divisions. They sold their reinsurance businesses. They sold the property and casualty division. Cigna used to sell car insurance, you know, not too long ago, but they've been out of that for several years. So they do what Wall Street tells them to do, and Wall Street will always tell them what to do. That's just a given. And if this legislation is implemented as intended, they will have to be operating under some constraints that Wall Street won't like, and they will be faced with making fewer, you know, smaller profits. They'll be very resourceful to try to make sure they can continue to meet Wall Street's expectations, but it will be harder. So a lot of them already are looking to other sources of revenue and doing other things. Cigna has a very big international division, has for several years. They make a lot more money every year abroad than they did the year before. They are very, very big in China. They were among the first insurers to get a joint venture partner in China while I was still there. It's a very big, big deal to them. And they sell cancer insurance in China with the bank. The bank has set up this telemarketing operation for Cigna to sell, they call it dread insurance. And I heard from a doctor who's Asian a few months ago that he wasn't surprised because he said in that culture there is an inordinate, well, at least more of a fear of coming down with cancer than there are in some other societies. And that's happening especially as China becomes more westernized. There's a wonderful book called The China Study in which researchers looked at the health and habits of Chinese people largely in rural areas compared to those in the West. And what was striking is that those of us in the West, we die of diseases of affluence. And that's largely unknown in China. There's far less heart disease, far less cancer. But as the country is changing, it's becoming more and more westernized. As we are feeding them fast food and having them selling them cigarettes and all that, their society is changing. So there are more incidents of cancer. So consequently, this is a huge, huge opportunity for Cigna. Yes, ma'am.
I worked for United Health for about a year and a half, so I've got a lot of good information.
We should talk.
Oh yes, I would love to talk. Regarding jobs, first of all, this is an at-will state, and United Healthcare knows that they can hire and fire anybody at will. So they have replaced a lot of jobs with overseas jobs, yep. And for them, or these big companies, instead of paying an American maybe $50,000, they can pay somebody over there maybe $500. Mm-hmm. And to the person in that country, that's a gold mine.
Yes.
And to us, we can't afford that. So what happens is they deliberately replace our jobs anyway, leaving us on the unemployment line, costing the taxpayers billions of dollars because they decide that instead of paying an American salary, we'll just lay that worker off and let the government take care of them. So in my personal situation, instead of paying me my salary, they also found out, because they have HIPAA violations, they were my insurer, so to speak, and my employer, they had records to all of my medical records. So if I'm costing them too much money, who's to say that they don't lay off people that cost them too much money? And so there is a lot, it's more than looking at it, oh, there'll be so much unemployment. Right now, these healthcare companies know exactly what they're doing.
Yeah.
And as far as I'm concerned, you know, I would really like to see something happen. It is, I mean, my personal circumstance, I was involved with the Department of Commerce, the Department of Human Services, the Department of Labor. They know what's going on with United Healthcare, and they feed into that. And I've got the records and the documents, and nobody wants to answer those questions of why the government deliberately feeds the money right into United Healthcare's pockets. And I would really like to talk with you or somebody who has that expertise, because they don't want to talk to the person who actually knows what's going on. I've spoken with Steve Hemsley's assistant many, many times. You know, mm-hmm. I was working 10 minutes away from there. And there's a lot more than this going on, but it all, I believe, ties into everything.
Well, it does. And one of the things I'm going to do next is return to journalism. I'm, as this was noted, Terry noticed when I was being introduced, I'm going to be working with the Center for Public Integrity, which is a journalistic organization that is preserving investigative journalism, and I'm going to be doing some work with them and launching something that at least we're calling for now Healthcare Watch, to keep an eye on the industry, how this legislation is being implemented. But you're right, there's a lot that that government officials at the federal and state levels know that the public doesn't know, but they have been doing this. I had the unfortunate task when I was in the industry of having to lay some staff people off, and they were people who were older, in their 40s and 50s, and that's often it's not so much that they have access. Maybe they do, and it would be illegal if they had access, of course, to your medical records. But they can get around that by just targeting people who are older, because they're usually sicker. I'll go with you first, sir.
Most Americans are terrified or have been indoctrinated to be terrified of socialism. Mm-hmm. And so if we're going to have private insurance companies providing the coverage, at least in the state of Minnesota, it has to be done by a nonprofit.
Yes, right.
Right. And so if, what would be the advantage of, say, moving towards the model that is utilized in Switzerland, where all of the insurance is provided by private nonprofit?
Right. Exactly. And I think it's certainly worth exploring that option too, because a lot of the countries in Europe that have assured universal access or have it have done it in different ways. There's no one silver bullet for this, and in any system there are problems. That you'll never build the perfect system. But you're right. In Switzerland and a few other countries, there are competing health insurance companies, but they're heavily regulated. They have to all sell a similar product. They have a minimum benefits package or a standard benefit package, and they are all nonprofit. And I think that we may be able to do that. Even this legislation could possibly get us there, because, as I was saying, if these for-profits can't make as much money in basic medical coverage as they have in the past, those investors will say, look, do something else. These companies already sell supplemental products, particularly United supplemental Medicare products, and they sell the U.S. companies sell supplemental products in the U.K. In the U.K., as you know, there's a the government the National Health Service covers everybody, but some folks, people are able to buy private insurance if they want to supplement that, to give them some additional services maybe not covered by the National Health Service, or some elective surgery or something that, again, is not covered. So that is something that might be possible here. So every country has looked at it a little bit differently and developed a model that seems to work best for them, or has worked for them at the time that it was being created. And I think that's what we ultimately will do. And I think there will be some resistance for a long time, maybe forever, to just pick the Canadian system and transplant it here. There'll be enormous resistance for that. If we had done it in the 60s like Canada did, we might have, before the health insurers became so much in control and so big and influential, it might have been a different story. Now, Vermont is going to be looking at possibly a single payer system in that state. The governor, the new governor, has said that he supports single payer, and they will be looking at three options soon. One of which presumably will be a single payer approach in Vermont. There are not a lot of big players that operate in Vermont. The biggest is a nonprofit, Blues. Cigna is second in the market. But you can rest assured that the big insurers will bring the heavy artillery into Vermont and try to scare people away from single payer, because they don't want a single state to fall. Imagine, what if Vermont did that and it worked beautifully and everybody in Vermont was covered and they were able to bring costs down and people had access to good coverage? It'd be a dream, wouldn't it, for Vermonters, but it would be a nightmare for the insurance industry. They'd be afraid that New Hampshire would be next, and then Connecticut, and all would be lost. Yes, ma'am.
I have a question for you, but I just, as an aside, want to say that we do have a Minnesota Health Act that's been presented in the legislature for a couple of years, in case you're not aware of it, and that was written by Senator Marty, who I see him somewhere around here.
So I just
wanted to mention that, and also that Dr. Show, who was the person who was hired by Vermont to do their study, came out with his results today.
Oh, have it? Yeah.
Yeah. So he came out with three.
Right.
And the one that he's recommending is his creation, or his team's creation, and it is a single payer public-private. And so you'll have to look at it, but it's a whole different model than we've really looked at before.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because he's trying to pacify everyone. So let me just thank you for coming out and writing the book. And I am wondering if there are other people who have been inside the insurance industry, working in it, who have been as bold as you to step outside and start talking about this.
I'll respond to your question first. No, if there were, you had heard about it. But even I was afraid to do this. I thought for a long time I could do this anonymously, just behind the scenes, and not put my everything on the line or at risk. But there's too much fear of retaliation and. Losing, you know, obviously when you do that, you have to leave your job. They're not going to keep you on the payroll if you do what I've done. I have heard from a lot of folks, though, quietly, who've encouraged me, and I do get a bit of information from them from time to time. So that's good. There are a lot of folks in there who know, in those companies, that know what I'm saying is true. They support me. I'm glad to get that piece of news, because I hadn't heard it was that those were released today in Vermont, and I'm not surprised at how you characterize it. I have suggested that we need to steal the language that the opponents of reform have used to win the hearts and minds of Americans. We all in this country think that if it's not invented here, it can't be good enough, and so we have to have an American solution. And I say, okay. The health insurers have said for a long time, we need to have a uniquely American solution. I'm all for it. Let's have a uniquely American solution to our problems here. And let's do approach this by having a public-private partnership to achieve that. And they use that language all the time as well. The devil in the details is it's what that mix will look like. And I'm eager to see the plans that he's proposing for Vermont, because I think the Americans could be sold on that language, and probably the way it's crafted in some ways that would be more sellable than some others might be. So thank you for that. Yes, sir.
This issue of not-for-profit, if we could just maybe touch on that. As you know, I heard you on the radio this morning. Technically, many of the insurance products, at least in Minnesota, are not-for-profit. David, maybe you can help me. I think it is legal to actually come in with certain products.
Only for Medicare.
Only for Medicare, okay. So all the non-Medicare business is not-for-profit. However, what we see in Minnesota is huge salaries of these not-for-profit insurers. The top salary might not overwhelm you as much, but they go very deep. It's a lot of people making well up into six figures, in some cases seven.
Yeah.
Secondly, huge reserves. They've been able to work our legislature to back off on the reserving and sort of on limiting reserves. So that I don't know, they go up, what, 3-4 months now, perhaps, or more?
There's no limit.
No limit at all, and so... given the investment climate up until the last couple of years, the ability to make a lot of investment money to, again, kind of fuel these salaries. So not-for-profit might be a little better, but there's still things to be looked at there. And I heard you this morning on the radio say that, well, not-for-profit might be a step in the right direction.
Well, it would be, and here's the problem, and here's why we have the situation you described. The rules of the road are determined by the big for-profits, And the nonprofits have to play by those rules as well, and they benefit from them. And they have surpluses or reserves, and they call it that rather than profits. And they are different, but they have a surplus of money. They don't have to return them to shareholders, which is a good thing. And some of them actually return them to the community, which is in some form of fashion, ultimately maybe, which is a good thing. But they can't offer policies that are significantly cheaper or of greater value, or people will catch on and sign up for them in droves. And the people who do will be sicker people. And that will create a death spiral. So they've got to be on guard against that. They can't let that happen, or they'll go out of business. They have to at least break even. And if you offer a really rich benefit plan at a good price, you'll attract the people that insurance companies don't want to attract, and that are people those are the people who need them. The other thing is, yes, salaries are high, but they're competing for talent. To get some of the best minds in to stay in those plans, they have to offer salaries that are comparable to what the big for-profits pay, or they'll lose some of the best minds. It would be nice to think that they could get and keep people who are altruistic and are willing to work long hours and really do it for the good of the country and those who are enrolled in those plans. And some people do that, I'm sure. But if they know that they might make more money at United and a recruiter calls, you know, you're going to listen. That's what happens. I mean, that's why I went to Humana. I was working for a nonprofit in East Tennessee, and I got a call about a job at Humana that paid quite a bit more, and I left them. And, you know, that's what happens. Yes, back there.
Physicians are key enablers of this fraudulent, unethical system.
Yes, they are.
I'm one of them. And I'd like to, you know, hear if you have any ideas about something akin to boycotting or actions that physicians could participate in.
I don't know the exact answer to that. One of the things I do advocate is to start thinking strategically. That's what the opponents of reform do. They come out of business schools. They know exactly how to develop a strategy and business plans. That's how they think. They're very, very sharp at that, and they spend a lot of time developing communications plans that are components of the strategy. Advocates don't come out of the same schools. They don't come out of corporate America usually. Physicians don't have that kind of training either. Physicians are concerned about their own welfare, their own ability to earn a living, so there's a lot of resistance from the physician community to change, as you well know, because they don't want to lose income. They are, like a lot of folks, more fearful of government than they are big business and big insurance. I don't know why, but they are. For one reason, it's just not, we are constantly bombarded with the message that we need to fear government. But we're not are nearly as educated on what really goes on inside the big corporations and how powerful they are and how much they control our government and our lives. There's just not that much awareness. And so even doctors who have a vested interest for their patients and really themselves in having a more equitable healthcare system often will just go along with the way things are or side with the opponents of reform. It happens all the time. I guess to answer your question, though, it has to be part of a well-thought-out strategy, and it's not impossible to do, but someone has to take the lead to begin to make it happen.
Yes, sir.
How do you think it's going to play out on a state-by-state basis with these Republicans fighting the individual mandate, Republican governors?
Yeah.
And how do you think that'll pan out? And also, their master plan, of course, is to defund this health care bill. That includes some of these consumer protections that you were talking about?
I'll start with that first. Yeah, they can possibly defund some things, but a lot of the things that they can't touch unless they do a repeal and replace are some of the consumer protections that don't require money. Telling these companies they can no longer use pre-existing conditions, that doesn't require money. having them have children on policies until they're 26 doesn't cost money. So they're telling them they can't cancel policies because they want to doesn't cost money. So a lot of the consumer protections don't cost another nickel, really. And there's nothing to defund. Now, there are a lot of pilot projects in the legislation. It's thick. And one reason it's 2,000-plus pages long is there are a lot of things that it does that are good, that set up pilot projects, for example, and determining and setting up nurse practitioner practices, for example, in markets where that are underserved by primary care doctors. That's a good thing, I think. So they could defund some of those worthy projects that do require funding. I think it'd be sad to do that. This requires a broad expansion of the Medicaid program to bring a lot of people into coverage, and the Republicans will not like that, and a lot of the governors will not like that. So that'll be attacked. But a lot of the consumer protections don't require any funding. What's at jeopardy, I think, are some of these pilot projects and other grants that will presumably given to community organizations to help improve the health status of people in the communities and helping people get access to care, and to increase the number of caregivers, including primary care doctors. That's in the legislation as well. Now, to your first question about the constitutionality of the individual mandate that has been attacked by Republican governors and attorneys general, many of those who filed those lawsuits were politically ambitious, if not all of them. It was politics, folks, that was behind that, not any great concern about the constitutionality of it. It was something that was easy for them to campaign on and get people riled up. And, of course, it's easy. If you're requiring people to buy something they like Obama said, that they feel like they can't afford, it makes me mad, too. The thing is that provision was carefully crafted, probably one of the most carefully crafted parts of the legislation, because it was known that there would be a challenge to the constitutionality of it. They have a lot of lawyers who draft this legislation like this who understand the Constitution quite well. And so I think the wording of this legislation is such that it will withstand the ultimate challenge in the Supreme Court. Two lower court judges have upheld the constitutionality of it. One has declared it unconstitutional. That's that Virginia judge. So there'll be other rulings, in the future. So it's already a mixed bag. The other thing is, again, this is what the insurance industry wants most. So they will be having a little talk too with the Republican governors and the attorneys general and say, look, guys, be careful what you wish for. Because if this is declared unconstitutional, that Virginia judge, by the way, said that he felt that provision was unconstitutional, but the other parts of the legislation would meet a constitutional challenge. So that is absolutely the insurance industry's worst nightmare, for the individual mandate to be declared unconstitutional, but the remainder of the bill to go forward. So that's why I'm not too attached to the outcome. One more question, and I'd like to talk with you more, but I've got to move on to another event. But any more questions before we wrap up for the day? Yes, sir, back there.
Well, I've said it before. I said it in Washington last March when you spoke in Congress, and I told the story of my sister's daughter who died because she had no access to health care, health insurance, but. I said thank you, and I'm going to say it again. I think you're a real hero. And,
oh, you're kind.
Amen. The question I have is, you must engage Republicans or
I am.
Opponents of yeah. the health care law. And what is it like? I'd love to be a fly on the wall and what is exchanged.
Well, you do have to approach it differently. And one of my goals for this year is to try to be on Fox more. And not just to get beat up. Just to be, new, fresh meat to them. But, what I'm talking about here is language to a large extent. And I need, if I do that, to be really on the top of my game, to be able to say things in a way that they will understand. And much of that is talking about the economy or the economic benefits of this and challenge respectfully some of their tenets of faith. And in a way that I want to tell stories and not just throw facts out there or seem to be an ideologue. So that's what I hope to try to do is to, and I'm not an ideologue. I'm not partisan. I'm not doing this to elect Democrats or liberals to public office. And I'm not doing this to make sure that we have a single-payer system. I don't know what's the best system for this country. I talk about what I know. I try not to get very much into opinion because I think I can be attacked on that. And someone, for example, in Indiana the other night, the last question he said, is health care a right or a privilege? And I said, well, it depends on your point of view. I have my opinion, but who cares what my opinion is? Thank you all very much. Thank you.